Welcome to 2819. I'm Sandra Dimes.
And I'm Brian Rollenbacher.
And today we're going to be talking about dinosaurs. We're very excited to talk dinosaurs.
That's right. I love Jurassic Park and the Jurassic World movies, so I'm all in. Apparently, there's nothing real about the movies, though.
What? What do you,
yeah, I don't. That's what Fuzz says, but I also know. He's never seen a Jurassic Park movie.
I know. It just we tried to get him to, you know, watch, but he says no. I think it's like a point of conversation that he likes to bring up whenever talking about dinosaurs. I've never seen Jurassic Park, so.
Yeah. Okay. You know what? Actually, how about we do a challenge with this? So Fuzz doesn't know about this, so he might not go along with it. But if we can get 50 people to comment Fuzzosaurus on this
video,
we will make him watch Jurassic Park and film a critique of him watching that movie and if he thinks it's scientifically accurate.
I mean, that would be fantastic, and I hope that means that it blows up and we get like a whole bunch of comments and likes and stuff.
Yes.
For Fuzzosaurus, right?
Yes, that's right. Fuzzosaurus. Anyway,
in Everyday Apologetics, we're going to hear from astrophysicist Hugh Ross, and he's going to cover when did dinosaurs live.
In Science Faith Connection, Jeff Zwerink will be talking with biochemist Fuzzle Rana, and they're going to discuss dinosaur blood and the age of the Earth. So it's such an important topic. I think, you know, people will learn a lot about soft tissue remains in dinosaurs.
Yeah. I'm curious myself about what exactly that means and how are they able to find it. So it's going to be a good topic. First up, though, is Culture Talk. Sandra and Hugh Ross are going to go over if dinosaurs are actually mentioned in the Bible. Let's check it out.
Welcome to Culture Talk. This is a segment where we talk about culturally relevant topics that you can use to start conversations about your faith. I'm joined today with astrophysicist Hugh Ross. Thank you for joining us today, Hugh.
Oh, my pleasure, Sandra.
You know, we're back in Zoom mode, but you know what? We're going to make this happen. We're very excited to talk about a topic that I think is pretty popular among our viewers. They are always curious about dinosaurs. So for this episode, we're focusing on dinosaurs. And for this particular segment, we want to focus on whether dinosaurs were mentioned in the Bible. So that is kind of the first question we need to tackle. Were dinosaurs mentioned in the Bible?
Yeah, I think not. For the simple reason, I believe that God inspired the Bible to speak to all generations of humanity, not just to those of us in the 20th and 21st century. Therefore, I don't expect the Bible to say anything about dinosaurs, about neutrinos, about Neanderthals, because those are scientific issues that only people living in the modern era would have been aware of.
Right. That is a very good point, because we always kind of view the Bible as our current place in time and expect it to kind of speak on all issues that aren't necessarily relevant to salvation. So when we think about dinosaurs, particularly whether they're mentioned in the Bible, kind of a common belief is that they are mentioned in the Bible when the Bible refers to Behemoth and Leviathan. So can you explain what those might actually be referring to, if not dinosaurs?
Well, what's interesting, Sandra, is that people were making that speculation, but only after dinosaurs were discovered. If you actually look at commentaries on the book of Job, that's where you find the Behemoth and Leviathan, is in chapter 40 and 41 of the book of Job. Previous to, say, the 19th century, the people were commenting on those chapters said, hey, this is obviously referring to the hippopotamus and the Nile crocodile. And because when it speaks about the behemoth in Job, it's a vegetarian, but it's a very dangerous animal, very dangerous if you get close to it, very powerful animal, and basically makes the point, hey, if you get close to either one of these animals, your life is in grave danger. And if you got a stick in your hand or a rock in your hand, it's not going to help you much.
So then when readers look at those verses referring to Behemoth and Leviathan, they can think of a hippopotamus and a crocodile instead.
Well, it's important, Sandra, also realize those two chapters will use sentences that speak about the literal characteristics of those animals, but it also uses, I counted 21 times where it uses the word as or like. which means that there's a lot of metaphor being used there. Mm-hmm. And the metaphors are always in the context of the human contactee, how you would feel if you had this close encounter. So for example, it says a Leviathan, it's like it's breathing smoke out of its nostrils and fire is coming out. It's not referring to a literal fire and smoke, but it's basically referring to how you as an individual would feel if you were face to face with a really big crocodile from say 10 feet away, you'd be utterly terrified. But if you look at the other sentences, it talks about how this Leviathan has this big tail that swishes through the mud, has these two rows of things on its back, which protect it. I mean, a crocodile indeed has a very thick hide, which protects it from injury. So and it has these row of teeth, fierce teeth. And so this well describes the Leviathan. And likewise, when you look at the behemoth, it talks about how it sits in the water, everything. And I think what gets people thinking this is dinosaurs is it talks about the behemoth having a tail the size of a cedar tree. And they say, well, a hippopotamus has a relatively tiny tail. But what they're not aware is that the original Hebrew word there, the word zanab, refers not just to the tail of the creature, but the hind quarters of the creature. And if you look at a hippopotamus, it's got extremely muscular, powerful hind quarters, and it uses those hind quarters as a weapon. So for example, you come into close encounter with a hippopotamus in a river or a lake, and they're not carnivores, but they're highly territorial. If you come into their territory, they're going to attack you. And what they're going to do is they're going to use their powerful rump. So there's lots of indications of people going down the Nile. And the thing about these hippopotami is they're extremely subject to sunburn. So during the daytime, they submerge themselves, or maybe all you see is two nostrils above the surface. And so it's easy to get into their territory without noticing them. And when that happens, they're going to take their powerful rump and capsize your canoe. And the crocodiles are well aware of the behavior patterns of the hippos. And so they hang around just outside the territory of the hippos. But when the hippos capsize a canoe, that's where they all rush in and they get an easy lunch.
Yeah. Well, I think that's helpful to kind of explain what those terms might be referring to. Now, I think for our science-minded friends, they might be used to hearing Christians argue that dinosaurs are mentioned in the Bible and that they actually coexisted with modern humans. So can you speak to maybe the timeline of when dinosaurs would have existed, at least from Reasons to Believe's perspective?
Yeah, I often get asked the question, well, okay, the Bible doesn't mention dinosaurs, but where would they fit into the biblical account? And if you look at Genesis chapter 1, we have God creating the first animals at the beginning of creation, day 5. And then towards the end of day 5, he creates the birds and the sea mammals. It doesn't mention the land mammals that he created until you get to day 6, where it talks about three subcategories. But that would tell me that the dinosaurs fit between God creating the first animals and God creating the more advanced birds and mammals. So between the two statements that you see on creation day 5. And likewise, I think it's implied in Psalm 104, where it talks about God creating life with maximum biomass and biodiversity. So when conditions are suitable for the dinosaurs, This is when we expect them to create them. And for big dinosaurs to exist, you're going to need huge, shallow seas. And that's what Earth had, those big, shallow seas on the continents between 240 and 66 million years ago. So that would be the time epoch from when you'd expect the dinosaurs to be in the face of the Earth. They can't be any more recent than that, because we didn't have shallow seas. I mean, it's a principle of physics. You can't have a big land mammal weighing in excess of what you see with elephants unless you've got water to support them. You need water buoyancy to make possible creatures, land creatures of that size.
So can you mention again then the specific time when dinosaurs would have existed?
Yeah, about 230 to 66 million years ago. There were three epochs, but all three of those epochs is when we had very big shallow seas on the continental land masses.
Right. Well, thank you so much for that. I know we're just barely scratching the surface here with this topic. And I believe that you talk more about this topic in your book, Hidden Treasures, in the Book of Job.
That's correct.
Right. So if viewers, you want more information on this topic, go to shop.reasons.org and look for Dr. Hugh Ross's book, Hidden Treasures in the Book of Job.
My son says I'm no rocket surgeon, so bear with my question here. And this is probably something you could have answered when you were age three, but it says, many churches teach that man has only been on earth for 25,000 years, and that's the age of the earth, and that's what the Bible says. So just how old is the earth, mankind, and dinosaurs in the Bible?
Okay. How old is the earth, mankind, and dinosaurs?
And does it take a rocket surgeon to know?
No, it doesn't. Planet Earth, 4.566 billion years, plus or minus 0.002 billion. So it's now known to four places of the decimal. And that's done through a radiometric dating and done through several independent lines. Dinosaurs show up for the first time after the Permian catastrophe. A gigantic asteroid hit the Earth 251 million years ago and actually turned the planet, you have about 20 feet of lava covering the planet because this thing just set up all kinds of volcanic events. And that wiped out 95% of all species of life on planet Earth. But very soon thereafter, the planet is repopulated with millions of new species of life, including the first dinosaurs, the Triassic dinosaurs. The Triassic dinosaurs persisted until about 220 million years ago, and they were wiped out by five small asteroids, well, not that small, each several miles in diameter, hitting the Earth, and that again wiped out about two-thirds of all species of life on planet Earth. But in this case, we know that the second generation of dinosaurs, the Jurassic dinosaurs, replaced all the extinct Triassic dinosaurs in less than 10,000 years. There's a little mudline we can find in the geological record that we know could not have been deposited in any more than 10,000 years. And then the Jurassic dinosaurs likewise get wiped out by an extraterrestrial collision event, replaced by the Cretaceous dinosaurs, and most people in the audience realize that a meteor or an asteroid that hit the Yucatan Peninsula 65 million years ago, wiped out the last of the dinosaurs. And then afterwards, again, we have millions of species of life. We have a lot of birds and mammals replacing these Cretaceous dinosaurs. And there again, we can document that the mass speciation event occurred less than 10,000 years after the mass extinction event. If I were to quote Psalm 104, all life dies off, but God recreates. He replaces the species of life that die off with new species of life. And there's a good reason why. I told you earlier, the Earth rotates more and more slowly because of the moon. So when life was first created on planet Earth, it was like 5 hours a day. Now it's 24 hours a day. The sun became 15% dimmer, and over the past 3 billion years, it's gotten 15% brighter. That means that certain life forms that are appropriate 500 million years ago would not be appropriate today. Therefore, God removes species of life that are no longer fit for the planet because of the changing conditions and replaces them with new species of life that are fit for the changing conditions. Meanwhile, all those previous species of life pile up a tremendous body of resources in the crust of the Earth: coal, oil, natural gas, sand, carbonates, limestone, and this is all the stuff we use to support civilization and technology. So thanks to these 3.8 billion years of life before us, we can not only exist as Stone Age peoples, we can launch modern civilization and technology. And if you read the Bible carefully, you'll figure out why God wanted us to develop civilization and technology. It's part of his plan.
Hello, Jeff Zwerink here. Welcome to Science Faith Connection, the segment of our show where we explore important scientific ideas to see how they relate to the truth of Christianity. Today, I'm joined by Dr. Fuzz Rana, and we're going to be looking at the issue of finding soft tissues in dinosaur fossils. Fuzz, good to have you here today.
Jeff, thanks for having me.
So this is a topic of young earth, old earth creationism. That's been a longstanding discussion in the Christian community. And kind of what's brought it somewhat more prominence recently is the discovery of soft tissues in dinosaurs. And so I thought it'd be fun to just have a discussion with you about what's the scientific data surrounding that and what do dinosaurs have to do with the age of the earth? So I guess first question I'll throw your way is, when scientists look at dinosaur fossils, why do they think they're millions of years old?
Yeah, well, you know, the scientific community, you know, has presented data that indicates that dinosaurs lived on Earth between 225 million years ago and about 65 million years ago, actually populating three different geological eras, the Triassic, Jurassic, and Cretaceous window of time. And the reason why scientists believe that dinosaurs, again, are millions of years old is on the basis of radiometric dating, where they use a variety of different radiometric techniques to age date the strata that the dinosaur fossils are discovered in. And this work indicates, again, that dinosaurs are, you know, between 65 and 225 million years ago in age. So, you know, there's overwhelming evidence towards that end that's largely predicated on radiometric dating methods.
Well, it seems like there's two aspects of that that indicates that at least dinosaurs lived long before humanity was around. One is the radiometric age dating of the strata. But if I get what you're saying, there's also the dinosaur only appear in certain strata. And so there's also, it's like there's two lines of evidence. Am I reading that correctly?
Yeah, yes, exactly. And for example, you know, the three different windows of time where dinosaurs appear have unique dinosaurs, for example, in the Triassic, unique dinosaurs in the Jurassic and in the Cretaceous. And these dinosaurs, again, as you mentioned, show up in characteristic strata. So there's an overwhelming collection of evidence, again, for dinosaurs being, you know, somewhere between 65 and 225 million years ago, depending upon the particular dinosaur in question. The radiometric dating methods are absolute methods, whereas the dating using the strata are relative methods, but those relative methods are reliable because they are anchored in the absolute methodology of radiometric dating.
Well, okay, so it seems like there does, as when I look at it in the scientific community, there's very little discussion of what the ages of these are. It seems like the scientific data really does point to those being millions of years old. And so that let's make this discovery of soft tissues in dinosaur fossils very interesting. Because so kind of explain, what is it that's been found that is soft tissues and why is that startling if the Earth is actually 65 million years old or dinosaurs were 65 million years ago?
Yeah, well, the paradigm in paleontology for a long time is that what's going to be preserved are going to be the hard anatomical portions of organisms, that the soft tissue materials will degrade away much more rapidly than the fossilization process can take place. And we understand why that's the case, because soft tissue materials are highly vulnerable to degradation from water in the environment, from oxygen in the environment, as well as environmental enzymes and microorganisms.
So before you go on there, just to clarify, what would be the kind of give a distinction between soft tissue and hard tissue? What would be some differences there?
Well, the hard tissue would essentially be the skeletal materials of the organisms or the shells, if you're looking at organisms that have shells. Those are the parts that are going to be preserved, maybe occasionally impressions of the soft tissue material might be preserved in the fossil record, but the actual remnants of the soft tissue itself, according to the standard paradigm, will not be preserved. And this whole paradigm was called into question thanks to the pioneering work of Mary Schweitzer, who is a paleontologist currently at North Carolina State University, where I think in 2003, she and her team reported the discovery of basically blood vessel remnants, red blood cell remnants, and molecular remnants associated with those structures in a dinosaur femur that dates at about 65 million years in age. And this was completely unexpected, but the evidence that she presented is very compelling towards that end. And so this literally overturned the paradigm. And since that time, there have been a large number of soft tissue remnants that have been discovered, not only in association with dinosaur fossils, but with a wide range of other fossilized organisms. The world's record is the recovery of chitin remnants in sponges that date around 500 million years in age. So these would be sponges that would have been on Earth at the time of the Cambrian explosion. And so this is absolutely remarkable to think that soft tissue material could survive for that length of time. And so the way that young Earth creationists think about this is that we know these soft tissue materials can't survive that long. And because they have, that means the fossils must be thousands of years old, not millions of years old. And therefore, radiometric dating methods are, in effect, unreliable.
Yeah, so that is actually a pretty remarkable claim and a pretty remarkable discovery, if I say so. I mean, there's not too often where you just find something that is just entirely unexpected. And, you know, at least at a first glance, the idea that we're finding soft tissues, I mean, this is like blood cells and skin. I assume that's the sort of stuff that we're talking about there. The fact that we're finding those sorts of tissues, that really does seem to lend a lot of credence to the idea that the Earth is a few thousand years old, else why would you still have this stuff around? So how as an old Earth creationist, do you wrestle with that data?
Yeah, well, it goes back to the point we made earlier, and that is there's absolutely no reason to think that radiometric dating is unreliable. And what this discovery indicates is not that radiometric dating is unreliable, it's that the paradigm that paleontologists were operating under with regard to preservation of soft tissue materials is essentially an invalid paradigm. And since that time, people have worked out how is it possible for these soft tissue materials to survive. And the first point to make here is that the environment for fossilization is really important. Certain environments lend themselves to preservation of soft tissue materials. Other environments do not. And it's also important to recognize that these scientists are not discovering blood vessels and red blood cells, but they're discovering the remnants of these materials where the chemical composition is changed from the original composition. It's just that the morphology of these materials is retained. And then also, we have come to understand that certain materials, molecular materials, are much more likely to be preserved because they're inherently more durable than other materials. We also have discovered that there's mechanisms that will alter these soft tissue materials and convert them into compounds that are much more durable than even the original materials themselves. And then finally, if these materials can be encased in a mineral entombment, that actually arrests the degradation process and allows them to be preserved for vast periods of time. So it's a combination of factors that have to be just right, but we now have a good understanding of what those are and can readily explain, you know, soft tissue material in fossil remains. It's not a mystery as to why these things have been preserved.
You know, your discussion there, just one of the comments you made stands out to me as a pretty remarkable thing. As you said, when confronted with this, the scientists had to realize that their paradigm needed to change. That's not a small statement, you know, because a lot of times it's the charge has been, oh, scientists are just set in their ways. They already know what they want to find, and so they stay there. So this idea that they're actually willing to change, radically change how they look at something that seems so straightforward, that soft tissues don't stick around, that really is a pretty remarkable change. What are your comments to that?
Yeah, that's very much the case. And, you know, to be clear, when Mary Schweitzer reported her discovery, there were a lot of skeptics that simply, because of the power of the paradigm, refused to believe that you know, what she had found actually was legitimate and authentic. But over time, as she has continued to build a case for the authenticity of her discoveries, other people have jumped in and have made similar types of discoveries. So today, I don't think anybody questions the recovery of soft tissue in fossils as being out of bounds or out of question. But the paradigm, people were resistant to the discovery because of the paradigm. But when the evidence was there, they were willing to change the perspective. They're willing to acknowledge that this was a flawed approach to, the taphonomy of fossil burial.
Thanks, Fuzz. I really appreciate your comments. You know, Christians are still divided over what the age of the earth is. And there are Christians who say that it's thousands of years and many Christians who say that it's millions of years. And what I love about this discussion of dinosaur soft tissues and the remnants and the impressions of them is that it helps us provide more data and really have a robust discussion of how old is the earth and what does that have implications for the authority of Scripture. You know, I would encourage you to go check out Fuzz's book. Go to reasons.org and look up Dinosaur Blood and the Age of the Earth. It will give you a great insight into this particular issue and how it can be used to support not only that dinosaurs lived millions of years ago, but more importantly, that the God who is the author and inspiration for Scripture is behind it all, that he cares about everybody and wants to reveal himself to you.
That does it for us this week on 2019. We hope you enjoyed this episode and that it helped equip you to share your faith with confidence and compassion, and that you had some fun learning about dinosaurs.
Yeah, and you know what? I think that you should subscribe to the show and also find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are at 2819 Show, and when you find us, let us know your favorite dinosaur. Mine is a thesaurus.
Ooh, actually, Brachiosaurus. I just got what you said. Well, if you'd like to get the audio version of 2819, we're on most major podcast services. Just search Reasons to Believe Podcast.
And don't forget, we want to get Fuzz to watch Jurassic Park, so be sure to leave a comment that says Fuzzosaurus.
Fuzzosaurus.
See you next week.
Bye.